This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Ascendant, Book One of the Ascendant series. Written by Craig Allanson. Performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Chapter One. Oh, this can be nothing but trouble, Bordrick declared with a grimace. Corin, best you stay in the barn. Bordrick had heard it first, while he was standing on the floor of the barn, and his son Corin was above in the hayloft, wrestling a bale of hay down for the cows to eat. It was a familiar, though infrequent, sound, the slow clopping of horse hooves, and the creaking, banging noise of wagons, slowly making their way up the narrow, rutted dirt road that led to the Bladewells' door. And only to the Bladewells' door. For their farm was at the end of the road, beyond which lay only the uninhabited forest that was the Duke's hunting reserve. One wagon, unexpected, was unusual enough at the isolated farmstead. More than one wagon? Such a thing had not happened in all the years Bordrick had lived there. He told Corin to hold the hay bale a moment, and stuck his head outside the barn to see who was approaching. Since there was no good reason for a caravan of wagons to come all the way up the hill from the village, on the lonely, axle-breaking, wheel-splintering, dead-end road to nowhere, it must be for a bad reason. A reason he could guess.
Pa, what's trouble? What is it?
Corin did not want to hear of any trouble on this of all days, his 13th birthday, the one day of the year when he was allowed to sleep late, so late that the sun had peeked over the low hills to the east and sent the golden rays of morning into his bedroom window before he had swung his feet onto the floor. So late that the chickens, sheep, and cows in the barnyard, even the deer lingering at the edge of the wheat field, and the crows strutting around the cornfield, wondered why Corin was not yet out of bed. So late that Corin had been sore from laying in bed that long, so late that by the time he had finally rolled out of bed when his mother called, he was more tired than if he'd gotten up in the pre-dawn darkness like he did every other day of the year. This day, there would not be the usual oatmeal or eggs for breakfast. His mother was making batter for hot cakes, and soon he would be sitting down to enjoy a giant stack of light, fluffy hot cakes layered with fresh butter and swimming in a lake of maple syrup the family had made from their trees that very spring.
Corin!
His father interrupted Corin's hungry daydream.
You listening to me? Stay here. Right here.
Audric stuck his head out of the barn door and spat on the ground in disgust. It was the county sheriff on a horse, leading several other horses and at least a half dozen wagons that Bordrick could see, strung out along the road, all headed toward the Bordrick's front door. This could not be good. For his neighbors to leave their own farms early in the morning and ride all the way up the rough road from the village center must be something serious. Not every farmer in the poor village of Krebsford could afford to own a horse, so many had crowded into their neighbors' wagons for the uncomfortable trip, and they all seemed to be staring and pointing at Bordrick as he stood outside the barn. He didn't wave to his neighbors. Arriving unannounced in large numbers and led by the sheriff was not neighborly behavior.
Ha!
Corin called from the hayloft, having crawled on hands and knees to lean out the loft door.
It's the sheriff! Are they calling up the militia?
He asked excitedly. There were rumors that the Royal Army had suffered yet another defeat, and if the orcs were bold enough, raiding parties would sweep down from their mountain lairs to the north. At 13, Corin was almost old enough to join the annual militia training that was held in the village square every winter, and he was looking forward to practicing with the militia, even if it was only with wooden swords and pikes. Sometimes the militia practiced archery, since only a handful of farmers had ever held a real sword. But everyone hunted, and Corin never missed with an arrow. He couldn't wait to show the village boys, and perhaps some girls, his skill with a bow.
"I see it's the sheriff, and if they were calling up the militia, they would have sounded the big horn at the golden trout. You finish feeding the animals and clean out the stalls, and you fix that fence post. Don't come to the house until I call you."
"But, Pa," Corin protested, having heard the wagons and burning to know what was going on outside the barn.
"What?" "Never you mind what's going on, boy. Get your chores done,"
Bodrick said gruffly, troubled by what he thought the sheriff's visit meant. And then he recognized the miller, perched on the seat of his wagon with his two boys, and he knew exactly what it meant, and his heart fell in his chest. And Corin saw the miller at the same time.
"Pa,"
his voice sounded strangled.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to—"
"You didn't do anything, son, and you don't listen to any foolish talk either. Mind your chores," he said, in a tone that invited no reply.
Bodrick strode across the field, fists clenched at his sides, until he was no more than a few feet from the sheriff, who had gotten off his horse and was standing with his own hands up in a peaceful gesture. Peaceful or not, the sheriff had a sword strapped to his waist and a dagger tucked into his belt.
"You had to do this on my boy's birthday,"
Bodrick snapped angrily to the sheriff.
"Bodrick, that's you and me talk inside."
Ignoring the sheriff, Bodrick strode toward the miller's wagon, shaking his fist.
"I'm not paying a single coin to fix your mill, you thief. If you'd have put any money toward keeping your equipment in proper order, it wouldn't have—"
The miller shouted louder, drowning out the farmer, his face beet red, standing up in his wagon.
"There was nothing wrong with my mill. Your son is a—"
"Enough!"
The sheriff stepped in front of Bodrick, blocking the way, rocking back awkwardly on his heels to keep the bigger man from moving forward.
"Bodrick, we need to talk about this inside. And you,"
the sheriff pointed sternly at the miller,
"sit down and keep your mouth shut."
"Ugh!"
He rested one hand on the grip of his sword for emphasis.
"Not one word from you. Jenks!"
The miller finished, but he sat down sulkily and said no more. Bodrick opened his mouth to speak when the sheriff leaned close and said in a low voice,
"Do you really want to do this out here, good sir?"
The sheriff glanced back at the villagers, who were all standing up in their wagons or sitting tall in the saddle, anxious to see what the sheriff would do.
"I'm here to protect you from these idiots."
Bodrick closed his mouth, grinding his teeth, while he considered whether to let pride, or good sense, win out. The crowd suddenly began muttering under their breath, some fearfully making hex signs with their fingers toward the barn. Bodrick turned his head to see Corin standing outside the barn door, hands clasped in front of him, his lower lip quivering as if he were about to burst into tears. With a gesture, Bodrick shooed his son back into the barn and, his shoulders slumped, stepped back.
"Sheriff, come inside my house. We can talk there."
In the Bladewells' cozy kitchen, which was more than warm because the stove was fired on a warm spring morning, the sheriff of Crichton County was wishing he hadn't worn his official uniform, which included a leather jacket. A leather jacket which trapped heat and made sweat trickle down his back, sticking his shirt to his back. He also wished the villagers hadn't insisted on riding to the Bladewells' farm quite so early in the morning, for he had skipped breakfast and was hungry, and seeing a bowl of hot cake batter with crocks of syrup, fresh butter and jam was making his stomach growl. He also felt rather ridiculous sitting in the kitchen of the Bladewells, a family he knew fairly well, while wearing his official uniform, including a sword. The sheriff regretted bringing the sword inside this peaceful house, but as he had brought the sword with him, he couldn't simply leave it leaning outside the front door. He knew the Bladewells fairly well, having dealt with them occasionally on business, for the Baron, and always on good terms. Knew them, and respected them, for Bawdrick and Emily Bladewell had turned the stony, weed-choked soil of the poor-yielding farm they had bought into the finest piece of farmland in the county. Their fields grew more grain, their cows gave more milk, their pigs grew faster, their chickens laid more and larger eggs. Compared to other farmers in Krebs Ford, the Bladewells were prosperous, and the sheriff knew that caused resentment in some people. Despite his admiration for the hard-working family, the sheriff ignored his growling stomach and his personal feelings on the subject, and did the job his distant cousin, the Baron, paid him for.
"My apologies, Mistress Bladewell," the sheriff said, as he unstrapped his sword and set it down on the table beside the door, "for bringing a weapon into your home."
Emily stood stiffly in her kitchen, torn between the obligations of a good host to a guest and the obvious fact that the sheriff was not in her kitchen as a guest. She had been about to crack eggs to make Corin's birthday cake when, glancing out the window, she had seen the sheriff leading a line of people up the drive to her door. The eggs sat untouched on the table by the stove, and her apron was draped over a chair. Emily did not want to appear before the sheriff on his official business while wearing an old apron with flour and hotcake batter on it. Every year the Bladewells gave a plump, smoked ham to the sheriff, and he accepted the gift gratefully. "We know you, Tom Mallow. You've sat at our table and enjoyed your fill of my cooking. There's no need for apologies, unless you've come here to do us harm." She squeezed her husband's hand, and he nodded to her.
"I came here to—" "We know why you're here, Sheriff," Bawdrick interrupted. "And I told you, we're not paying a single coin to fix that mill."
"I didn't,"
Bawdrick continued, as if the sheriff hadn't spoken.
"Our boy wasn't even inside the mill that day. Did he tell you that? Wasn't near the miller's broken-down old gears."
"Bawdrick, I'm not here to collect money,"
the sheriff managed to say while Bawdrick caught his breath. Husband and wife shared a surprised look. Emily felt a chill down her spine. The family could not afford to fix the watermill's equipment, and despite whatever lies the miller had told, Corin hadn't done anything. A demand for money was at least understandable. And if not to demand money, why had the sheriff and what looked to be half the village come to the Bladewells' farm?
"He's not asking for money to fix the mill."
The sheriff shook his head.
"The Baron has advanced funds to repair the mill, and is bringing in a skilled work crew from Norville to get the job done by the end of the summer, before the harvest."
"That sounds expensive,"
Bawdrick observed warily.
"The Baron knows that without the mill, people in this village can't pay their taxes. And the Baron will still owe his taxes to the Duke, so..."
Bawdrick nodded. Sheriff Tom Mallow had been friendly, having grown up in Krebs Ford before his distant cousin the Baron appointed Tom as county sheriff, but that friendliness was based on the Bladewells paying their taxes in full and on time. Other families in Krebs Ford and throughout Crichton County did not find the sheriff friendly at all. Not when he was taking away the grain they needed to survive the winter, or taking cows, pigs, or chickens the family needed, or even bringing in men of the Baron's Guard to help the sheriff force a poor family off their land when the family had been unable to pay their taxes. Bawdrick and Emily had bought their farmland at auction, after the previous owners had lost their property to the Baron for failing to pay taxes. Emily still vividly remembered the look the unfortunate family had given her as they rode their wagon down the road, away from the land that had failed them.
"If you're not here for money, then why?"
Emily asked, pointing vaguely out the window toward the people lined up along their road.
"To protect you, for one," the sheriff answered unhappily.
"Protect us?"
Baudric angrily squeezed his wife's hand without realizing what he was doing.
"From our neighbors?"
he asked, astonished. Like any small village or town, some people could be petty or even mean-spirited, but Baudric had never known anyone to be violent, unless they had too much of their homemade drink. And he couldn't imagine so many of his neighbors drinking that much so early in the morning.
"Baudric, Amelie, people are scared," the sheriff said quietly.
"Scared?"
It was Amelie's turn to grip her husband's hand tightly.
"Scared enough to call for a priest or a wizard to do something about Corin. The miller has people terrified. He's been sitting in the Golden Trout every night, whipping people into a frenzy. And Mistress Pettifogger has been helping him by providing free beer."
The sheriff made a disgusted face, as much as the innkeeper's stupid behavior, as the poor quality of the inn's beer.
"Afraid of my boy?"
Amelie gasped.
"Superstitious idiots," Baudric grumbled.
"Idiots they may be, but there was talk of people coming up here with torches and burning you out. They want you to leave."
"Leave?"
Amelie nervously twirled around her finger the blue ribbon that tied back her dark hair.
"Baudric's family has farmed land around Krebsford for 3 generations, and Corin is not dangerous. He's just a boy, barely 13. I'll certainly not have the likes of Priscilla Pettifogger,"
Amelie waggled her finger toward the kitchen window,
"chase me away from my home."
Priscilla, wife of the town's innkeeper, was a thin, unpleasant woman who always had a disapproving look on her face, like she smelled something bad, and it must be you. The only time people ever saw Priscilla smile was when she was trying to curry favor with the Baron or his family. Some people said that avoiding Priscilla is why the Baron never visited Krebsford anymore. Not that the Baron ever spent much time in such a small, poor village, the Baron being busy doing important Baron things, like ruling all of Crichton County. As long as the people of Krebsford paid their taxes when the Baron's sheriff came to collect at harvest time, the Baron could not have cared less what his subjects did in the tiny, poor village of Krebsford. The only time the Baron passed through Krebsford these days was in his 4-horse carriage, on his way to visit the Duke. And the Baron would likely have avoided Krebsford entirely, if not for the fact that the bridge in the village was the only way across the river for 25 miles in either direction. Older folk in the village joked that they could remember when the Baron's carriage was pulled by only 2 horses, before the Baron grew so fat. Such things were not, of course, ever said outside of one's own home, the Baron being very vain about his appearance. It was the Baron's total lack of interest in the goings-on of the inhabitants of Krebsford that left Tom Pettifogger, owner of the Golden Trout Inn and the wealthiest man among the poor people of Krebsford, the leader of the village. And since Tom had no interest in acting as mayor, and more than anything wanted to keep his wife busy so she would not have time to nag him to death, Priscilla was left in charge of the day-to-day goings-on around Krebsford. The source of the Pettifogger's dispute with the Bladewells happened back around Corin's 8th birthday, when his father brought him into the common room of the Golden Trout, after they had sold a cow for what Baudric felt was more than a fair price. Baudric was in a very jolly mood, so he had decided to celebrate with a cold mug of beer in the common room of the Golden Trout. Corin was sitting with his father, while Baudric sipped beer, told stories, laughed, and discussed the weather with the other farmers, while Corin decided he wanted to try this beer that all the men were so eager to drink. His father had gotten up from the table to play a game of darts, and left his half-full mug of beer behind.
No one was watching Corin in the dark corner of the common room.
One sip, that's all. Just one little sip, he told himself.
But the stoneware mug was heavy, and at first he didn't tilt it enough to make the beer close enough to sip. Then he tipped it too far and got a mouthful.
Just at the moment Corin's eyes flew open wide in surprise, and he choked on the bitter brew. The giant wooden vat in the back room of the Golden Trout burst open, and 200 gallons of what Tom Pettifogger claimed was the best beer in Crichton County came crashing through the door into the common room, washing away tables, chairs, and customers alike. Now, whether Tom Pettifogger's beer was the best brew in the county, as he claimed, or, as some of his customers grumbled, was stale swill, not fit for horses to drink, was in dispute. Not in dispute was Tom and Priscilla's shock and anger, and also not in dispute, as far as the Pettifoggers were concerned, was who was to blame. Corin. The great beer flood wasn't the first time that Corin had been present during an unfortunate incident in Krebs Ford. In fact, Corin had a reputation as a jinx. There is no nice way to say it. Corin was considered to be a jinx, a bad luck charm. Strange things simply seemed to happen when Corin was around. Bad things. Unfortunate things. Not that anyone ever saw Corin actually do anything to make bad things happen. They simply happened. And always, when young Corin was involved. The first couple times bad things happened around Corin, people laughed and said, Vardrick needed to be careful about that boy. But when the blacksmith's forge roared into a fire so hot it caused a white-hot pillar of flame to shoot up through the roof of the shed, at the exact moment young Corin yelped from burning his hand on a hot poker, people began not so much to talk as to grumble. Began to mutter under their breath, to give Corin odd, unfriendly glances, and to wonder if, in fact, Corin really was indeed a jinx. Even sensible adults began to wonder if Corin was somehow cursed with bad luck. So, when the Pettifoggers loudly banished Bawdrick and his boy from their inn after the great beer flood, no one in the village stood up for the boy. No one could say for sure that Corin wasn't a jinx. Now could they? When Priscilla tried to make Bawdrick pay for the damages, well, people said she had gone a bit too far. And most of the townsfolk took Bawdrick's side when he told Priscilla exactly what he thought of her, the Golden Trout, and of their sour, flat beer. After all, what Bawdrick said was what pretty much everyone in Krebs Ford had wanted to say for years. Behind Priscilla's back, of course. Relations between the Bladewells and the other families in Krebs Ford were strained for years after that, with half the townsfolk saying Corin was a menace, half saying there was no such thing as a jinx, and half saying, well, there might be something to this talk about a jinx. There were three halves, because some people changed their minds about Corin, depending on the day, or the weather, or what they ate for breakfast. Truth was, most people in Krebs Ford, and all of Crichton County, were poor farmers scraping out a living on land they rented from the Baron, and could not afford bad things to strike them or their family. Life was hard enough, without a jinx making things worse. A lame horse, a broken plough, a hailstorm wiping out a field of crops, almost anything could spell disaster for a family already on the edge of poverty. And some people resented that the Bladewells owned their land, and their home was one of the best pieces of farmland in the entire county. It was most unfortunate, therefore, that Bawdrick took Corin with him to the grain mill, a couple of weeks before Corin's 13th birthday. That mill, along with the bridge across the river, were the only reasons for the village of Krebs Ford to exist. Although no one particularly liked the miller, and his boys were bullies, the miller was grudgingly honest, and his prices for grinding grain were mostly fair. And the closest other mill was a full day's journey along the river to the west. When they arrived at the mill that fateful morning, Ordric left Corin to tend to the wagon and get water for their horse. Corin carefully put wooden blocks under the wagon's wheels, unhitched the horse, and led the horse to the Milray stream to drink. The miller's two boys, seeing a chance for a bit of mischief, crawled over to the wagon and slipped the blocks from under the wheels. They were trying to hide in the tall grass and keep from laughing out loud when they noticed that the wagon was rolling the wrong way, rolling straight for their father's mill. What the miller's sons should have done was to stop the wagon, but because they were cowardly bullies, they lay still and hoped they could blame it on Corin. When Corin saw the wagon rolling toward the mill, he shouted in alarm, which caused the horse to bolt away. Corin ran after the wagon as fast as his legs could carry him, and grasped onto the tailgate, digging his heels into the dirt and trying to pull the wagon to a halt. The wagon was far too heavy for the boy. It dragged him with it as it rolled straight for the door of the mill. Corin swung his legs up, planted his heels in the dirt road, closed his eyes, and gave one mighty heave with all his strength. And the wagon did stop. At the same moment that the great water wheel of the mill also stopped, causing the machinery inside the mill to break, shatter, and fly around inside the stone building. Ordric and the miller ran out of the mill, holding their arms over their heads, and flung themselves flat on the ground, while the water wheel jerked back to life, sending more large pieces of machinery flying about. The miller's boys ran up to their father, blaming Corin for the wagon almost crashing into the mill, but the miller did not care about any stupid wagon. His mill, his precious mill, was ruined. Ruined. And he might not have it fixed in time for the autumn harvest that year. What a disaster for the miller, and for the farmers of Krebs Ford, who now had no place to take their grain for grinding. The miller was sputtering with anger, pulling out tufts of his beard and yelling words that Corin's mother had told him were very bad things to say. And saying bad things about Corin, that it was all Corin's fault, that the boy was a jinx. Ordric shouted back that if the miller had taken proper care of his clunky machinery, it would not have broken. Both men were red-faced from shouting. They almost came to blows before Ordric told Corin to catch the horse, hitch it to the wagon. They would be leaving. "Good riddance," said the miller, "and don't come back, ever. The Bladewells could bring their grain to some other mill in the future. He would not be grinding it for them ever again." The miller went to the Golden Trout Inn that evening to drown his sorrows in a mug of beer, and the more he drank, the louder and more angry he became. Something would have to be done about that Corin Bladewell boy. Something soon, he declared to anyone who would listen. Among the farmers in the common room of the Golden Trout that night, he found an agreeable audience. The news that the village's only mill might not be available to grind their grain, with crops planted and harvest time approaching, spelled disaster for everyone in Krebs Ford, not just for the miller. Corin was a menace, a danger to poor, honest, hard-working people who could not afford any more bad luck in their lives. When Priscilla Pettifogger announced that it was time for action, not more talk about Corin, no one spoke against her. When Priscilla spoke to the sheriff of Crichton County and explained how much trouble Corin had caused, the sheriff knew his employer, the Baron, would care only about two things. First, that tax payments from Krebs Ford might be reduced or delayed because there was no local mill to grind the farmer's grain, and second, that Priscilla Pettifogger was very upset and worked up about the issue of Corin Bladewell, and that she was very likely to be pestering the Baron until he did something about it. The problem with tax payments was serious, for the Baron had to pay his taxes to the Duke, whether the Baron had collected taxes from his subjects or not. But the sheriff remembered the last time Priscilla had pestered the Baron about something. The woman had been so persistent and so annoying that the Baron had taken to riding far out of his way to avoid going through Krebs Ford, and had even begun to dread reading his mail, lest he find yet another strident message from Mistress Pettifogger. So the sheriff was not sure the Baron would care about the taxes, as much as caring about keeping Priscilla from pestering him again. What the sheriff did know for certain was that the Baron expected his sheriff to take care of problems in the county, which is why the sheriff rode directly to the Baron's castle, explained the problem, and suggested a solution. A solution the Baron liked very much indeed. The morning of Corin's 13th birthday, the sheriff met a group of scared and angry people from the village who were assembled at the Golden Trout, and led them to ride slowly up the lane to the Bladewell's farm. Bordrick released his wife's hand and put his hands on her shoulders, pulling her against him.
"You can tell those people outside that we'll not leave our home because ignorant fools are scared of silly superstition."
He spoke through clenched teeth, his jaw set in defiance.
"It's going to be all right, honey. We're staying right here, plain and simple."
The sheriff shifted his feet uncomfortably.
"It's not that simple."
He pulled a scroll from a pocket and laid it on the kitchen table.
"This has gone beyond the Pettifoggers, or the miller. My lord the Baron has declared your son banished."
"Banished?"
the Bladewells shouted together.
"And he's offered a fair price for your land,"
the sheriff continued, pulling another scroll from his pocket.
"A more than fair price. Even generous."
"This is outrageous! The Baron—"
"Who is your liege lord, I caution you, Mr. Bladewell,"
the sheriff said quickly, with one finger held up for emphasis.
"It would not do to speak ill of the Baron in front of his sheriff, I remind you."
Bordrick fumed, but held his tongue from saying what he felt about the Baron.
"We will fight this,"
he said weakly, feeling he had to say something.
"We can appeal to Her Grace the Duchess."
The sheriff shook his head sadly.
"Bordrick, yes, you can appeal to the Duchess at the Assize Court next winter, if you travel to the castle. By that time, if you haven't taken the Baron's offer, he will force you off your land."
The sheriff didn't need to mention that it would be he and his men carrying out the Baron's orders.
"And sell your land at auction. And I can tell you, good sir, the Baron will make sure he is the only bidder at the auction, and you will be the poorer for it."
"I know him. He'll do it."
"Do you think the Duchess will side with you over the Baron, who is cousin to the Duchess's husband?"
Bordrick found his hands were shaking as he held his wife, and she looked up at him with tears in her eyes. His own eyes stung, but he was determined not to show that to the sheriff.
"This can't be happening. Not to us. How can our neighbors, people we've known for years, be afraid of our boy? He's a good boy."
"There have been odd things going on around Corin for years now,"
the sheriff said gently.
"Odd? Rumors and silly stories,
enough to scare people,"
the sheriff interrupted. Amelie wiped the tears from her eyes. She wasn't sad or shocked. She was angry.
"I didn't hear people complaining when Corin helped harvest their crops over the years, or when Corin nursed Redding's cow back to health.
That animal was near death's door, and Corin stayed by its side day and night. And now it's scampering around the fields like a calf. Strange things happen all the time round here. Was it Corin's fault when that twister storm tore up the Rendles' barn? Or when the flood last year knocked out the bridge? Or when lightning struck the blacksmith shop? Were all those Corin's fault?
Amelie, Baudric, I can't dispute that Corin has been a good boy. Hard-working, always ready to help people. Maybe there's something strange about him, maybe there's not. Maybe it's all superstitious stories. All I can say is that my master, the Baron, has declared your son banished, and he has until Midsummer's Day to leave the county. The two of you don't have to leave.
We're not sending our son away,
Mother and Father said in unison. Not knowing what else to say, for everything that could be said had been, the sheriff pointed at the scrolls on the table, tapping them emphatically with a finger.
You have been officially notified of our liege lord the Baron's declaration of banishment, and of his offer to purchase your property. I am going outside to calm people down and get them off your land. I'll be back here next week, by myself, and you can tell me your decision then. Until then, I suggest you stay out of the village.
So it was, the week before Midsummer's Day, the Bladewell family loaded the few possessions they hadn't already sold into their wagon, and started down the narrow, rutted lane into the tiny village of Krebs Ford. Baudric had sold the farm and all their animals except the horse to the Baron. The sheriff, who had delivered the Baron's money, waved to Baudric as the wagon passed, but the sheriff wasn't smiling, and neither were the Bladewells. The sheriff wasn't smiling because he felt sorry for the Bladewells. It had been the sheriff's idea for the Baron to send them into exile. The legal term was banished, but exiled sounded better, as if the Bladewells had a choice at all. And, technically, the Bladewell family had not been exiled, only their 13-year-old son. Another reason the sheriff was not smiling was that he knew the Baron had likely paid too much for the Bladewells' farm. The amount of money the Baron had paid to the Bladewells was based on the amount of crops and animals the farm produced under the hard work of the Bladewell family. But the Baron had, foolishly, granted the farm to his youngest son, so the boy could learn the practice of farming and animal husbandry. The lazy boy didn't know anything about farming, was apparently allergic to hard work, and was going to fail as a farmer. And the sheriff knew the Baron would not be happy when the most productive farm in the county fell into disrepair, and the sheriff would get the blame. So he waved to the Bladewells that morning, and no one was smiling. Baudric had to drive the wagon through the village, for the east road was the only way across the bridge. It was early, yet. Most people were either still in bed or tending to chores around their farms. The few people they met fell into two groups, those who glared at them as if to say, good riddance, and those who avoided their eyes or pretended to be sad the Bladewells were leaving. A mile down the lane, they passed by the farm of Baudric's brother, Ander, who was pretending to fix a fence post, as an excuse to be out by the road.
Ander, Baudric said with a nod toward his brother, and he brought the wagon to a halt.
Morning, Baudric, Ander responded uncomfortably. So, you're leaving then? I hear the Baron gave you a good price.
That's between me and the Baron, Baudric said bitterly. Yes, we're leaving. As if you didn't know that. You're not going to say you wish I would stay?
Ander looked down at his shoes. I have a family too, Baudric,
and you can't say your boy hasn't been around every time something bad happens around here.
You should be ashamed of yourself, Ander Bladewell, Amelie snapped. Superstitious foolishness. Corin is a good boy. Don't you forget about the time Corin nursed your horse back to health when you'd given up. Was that bad luck for you? Podrick, we're not wanted here. Let's move on, before I lose my temper and say something uncharitable.
Podrick tapped the reins, and the horse pulled the wagon away, without another word to his brother. It had been Anders' betrayal that made Podrick decide to move. He did not care what the pettifoggers, or the miller, or anyone else in the town thought, but when Podrick had looked out his front door that fateful morning, to see that his own brother Ander had joined the people seeking Corin to be banished, Podrick had not known what to say. His own brother wanted him banished from the town. Corin's mother and father had argued late into that night, before wearily deciding to sell the farm and make the long journey to a distant village where one of Amelie's relatives lived. There they could buy another farm and get a fresh start. First, though, they had to get through Krebs Ford. Their route through the village was mostly quiet until they passed by the mill with its broken water wheel. The miller's sons came out to jeer at the Bladewells, and then they were joined by other boys, bullies who saw that none of the adults in the village would step forward to defend the Bladewells. The family kept the wagon moving and ignored the insults, but then the bullies began throwing clods of dirt and other things. An overripe pepper splattered against the wagon next to Corin. Then a boy threw a large potato at Corin's head. Quick as a flash, Corin caught it out of the air and drew his arm back to throw the potato when Podrick caught his arm.
Don't waste good food, son. You took that in the back of the wagon, and we'll eat it tonight.
The wagon went around a sharp turn in the road, rumbled up the cobblestones onto the bridge, and they left the village of Krebs Ford behind forever. That first night, camped beside the road, Corin had to admit his father was right. The potato was good, and almost big enough to feed the whole family. For a moment, in front of a crackling fire, camped out under the stars, Corin could almost pretend he was on a fishing trip, and they would return home in the morning. In the morning, they did not return home, and Corin awoke with a back stiff from sleeping on the ground beneath the wagon. His parents had spent the night in the back of the wagon, using what little cushioning they had to comfort their older bones. Corin got the morning fire started, and brought a pail of water to his mother to boil for the breakfast oats.
I didn't notice it last evening, Podrick declared, but I believe this land used to be an orchard. Corin, come with me. We'll see if we can find some plums.
The tangled, overgrown trees indeed used to be an orchard, although it was hard to tell from the road. Most of the trees were apple, with fruit not yet ripe enough to pick. Plums, though, were to be found here and there, with most of that fruit already laying rotting on the ground. Podrick kept a wary eye out for bears, for such an abundance of fruit would surely draw animals to feast, and some trees bore telltale claw marks. A bear, Podrick warned his son, was bad enough, but a bear drunk on fermented fruit was a true danger. Father and son wrestled their way through the overgrown branches to find ripe plums that hadn't fallen, and, as always, Corin somehow knew just where to find the best fruit. Soon, Podrick stayed on the ground while Corin handed plums down to him. For a moment, just a moment, clambering around tree limbs, with warm morning sunlight filtering through the leaves, the air scented with ripe plums, Corin could almost forget that they would not be bringing the fruit home, that he wasn't picking from trees in their own orchard.
You saw the old stone wall under all that brush as we got here, Bodrick observed. This must have been someone's farm. A long time ago, looks like.
Why would someone abandon a good farm like this? Corin asked, puzzled. The plum, apple, and peach trees were terribly overgrown. What must at one time have been a wheat or cornfield was a meadow full of bushes and sapling trees. But when Corin had kicked over a rock, he had seen rich, black soil. Bodrick shook his head.
Could be anything. Sickness, accident, no children to take over work in the land, taxes, or the owner wanted too much rent. I wonder if our baron owns this land, Bodrick said with a grimace. A spot of bad luck, that's all it takes, to knock a family off their land.
Intent on picking plums and talking halfway to himself, Bodrick wasn't paying attention to what he'd said to his son.
Corin's ears burned with shame. A spot of bad luck. Like having a jinx for a son.
I'm sorry I caused problems for you and mother.
Oh!
Bodrick realized what he'd said, and that he couldn't take back or explain away his words.
I didn't mean to... It's not your fault, Corin. Don't worry on it.
Am I a jinx? Corin asked,
knowing his father would tell him the plain truth whether he wanted to or not. Bodrick was that way.
Corin, I don't rightly know, Bodrick said after a pause. Strange things seem to happen when you're around, that's the truth. I can't deny it.
When the mill's water wheel broke because it stopped for no reason, Bodrick had been as frightened as the miller.
If you're a jinx sometimes, well, you've been good luck, too. Good luck for us, for sure. And you nursed old Mr. Redding's cow back to health when he'd given up on it. Right? Don't know what you did, but that old cow was back up and giving milk in a fortnight.
Corin nodded. He had helped out when old Mr. Redding needed an extra hand on his farm. And when Redding's only cow had fallen down in her stall, glassy-eyed and moaning, Corin had convinced the man to let him try saving the animal. The poor old cow had lain on her side, muscles twitching, burning up with fever, and taking neither food nor water. Corin had stayed there for 2 days and nights, stroking the animal, and the twitching stopped, and the moaning went away. And when he spooned sugared water into the cow's mouth, it licked it up. If Corin left the cow's side, it moaned in pain. So he stayed right there, keeping a hand touching its hide, and draping an arm over the cow when he caught a few minutes of sleep. Mr. Redding had been so grateful he had given that cow's next calf to Corin. Corin had always been especially good with animals. The Bladewells' chickens laid more and bigger eggs, the cows gave more milk, the sheep's wool was thick and grew quickly. Jealous neighbors grumbled that the soil under the Bladewells' farm was very rich, so of course their crops and animals were healthy and productive. Bodrick's back, which ached from the hard labor of picking stones out of the soil and spreading manure as fertilizer, would deny the soil there was anything special before he bought the land.
You weren't around when that hailstorm wiped out a whole field of the Pritchard's wheat. That weren't no jinx. Nor the flood that knocked supports from under the bridge. Nor the forest fire a couple years back that sent sparks onto the roof of the Golden Trout and almost burnt the place to the ground. I didn't hear old sour-faced Priscilla Pettifogger mention that when she came to complain about you. Now did she?
Bodrick said with a wink. Corin couldn't help a quick grin.
Don't you worry on what people think about you, Corin. If you're a jinx, well, there must be a lot of jinxes around, seeing as how so many bad things happen. You hold your head up, and don't get to feeling bad about yourself. It don't do any good to be sitting around moping about how bad you got it in life,
There's always somebody got it worse.
Bodrick held a perfectly ripe plum up to his nose and inhaled the sweet scent.
Let's get these back to your mother. She'll be well pleased.
A couple days later, in the afternoon, the family stopped outside of a village. Corin would wait in the woods while his parents went into the town to buy supplies and get directions. Corin was ashamed to see his own parents considered that their son was a jinx. They wanted to keep him away from any possible trouble by keeping him out of towns along the way.
"It's not that we think you're going to jinx anything, Corin," his father said, while he avoided looking his son in the eye. "But, well, you see, we can't afford to have any incidents while we're on the road."
They would be back before dark, they assured Corin. He was to stay in the woods and out of sight. And out of trouble. Corin watched from the woods as the wagon rolled out of sight down the road. Then he kept himself busy, picking an entire hatful of wild berries. His mother would be pleased to have fresh berries when she returned. Having stripped the raspberry bushes of ripe fruit, he began looking for wild roots, the way his father taught him. He found and dug up a fair-sized pile of wild carrots when he noticed it was growing dark, and his parents hadn't returned. Corin carefully crept back to the road and watched for his parents until the light faded in the western sky and stars began to twinkle. When it grew so dark he could barely see his hand in front of his face, he made his way back to the clearing where he had left his pack, and soon he got a fire going. When his parents returned, they would see his fire from the road. The stars winked out, one by one, as the sky filled with clouds, and rain began to fall. Corin rigged up a tarp to sit under, and tended to the fire, as big, heavy raindrops popped and hissed when they fell onto the fire. He sat up, long into the night, jumping at every sound in the forest around him. Finally, he could not keep his eyes open, and he fell asleep under the tarp. In the morning, the fire was cold, and there was still no sign of his parents. Mindful of his parents' warning to keep off the road, Corin walked in the woods, parallel to the road, until he came over the crest of a small hill, and could see the town stretched out in the valley below. It looked much like Krebs Ford. A few buildings clustered together, along a road near a river, surrounded by farm fields. Corin noticed that some of the buildings had brightly colored flags, and Corin realized with a start that the next day was Midsummer's Day celebration. There was no sign of his parents' wagon. The rain had stopped, and the sun came out, which lifted Corin's dark spirit. After sitting on a log and pondering what to do for a full hour, Corin stashed his pack behind a tree and made his way across a field into town. Pushing aside a tangle of pricker bushes, he stepped out onto the road. The keeper of the town's inn wiped his flour-covered hands on his apron and stepped out the side door of the inn to where he had several pies cooling on a window ledge. Anticipating a crowd in town for the Midsummer's Day festival, he had baked twice as many pies as usual, and carefully selected the fruit to put into each pie. The innkeeper was, then, outraged to see one of his pies was missing. Missing! Gone! Stolen! And he knew who had stolen his precious sweets. There was a troublemaking group of boys around the village, boys who had not enough chores to keep them busy around their farms. With a bellow of rage, the innkeeper flung open the gate of the inn's yard and charged out into the road. The first person he saw was a boy with dark, curly hair standing in the road with his back to the inn. Corin spun around in alarm when the innkeeper shouted at him,
You there, boy! Don't you run away from me!
The innkeeper shouted. And, of course, what Corin did was run. Run as fast as he could. The innkeeper shouted for people to stop the boy. Corin ducked when a man tried to grab him, ducked again, rolled on the ground, scurried to his feet, and plunged through the pricker bushes and off the road. He pelted his way across the field, and had gone only a few strides when he stumbled into a brush-choked ditch he hadn't seen, stumbled and fell into the muddy bottom of the ditch. Men crashed through the bushes, cursing as thorns tore at their skin and clothing. Corin lay still in the ditch, hidden under bushes. He could see men's boots at the edge of the ditch, and he recognized the innkeeper's voice.
Where did that boy get to?
I can't see him, another man said. This is far enough for me. Look, I've ruined this shirt. My wife won't be pleased.
We have to catch that boy, the innkeeper said. We have to nip this in the bud, I tell you. If we let that sort into our town...
Yes, yes, said another man impatiently. Nip it in the bud. That's what you always say. Well, we've chased him away.
The men grumbled as they carefully made their way back through the bushes, until only the innkeeper's boots were visible.
I'll thrash you if ever I catch you, boy,
the innkeeper shouted as he shook his fist at the field.
Decent folk don't want your kind around. You stay out of our town, you hear me? Nothing but trouble you are. Nobody wants you around.
Huffing and puffing from shouting, the innkeeper stood still for a long minute, before crashing through the bushes back onto the road. Corin lay still, barely breathing, in the ditch, until he was sure the men had gone. Slowly, he crawled through the mud along the bottom of the ditch, climbing out of the ditch only when he reached the edge of the field. Keeping low in the woods, he made his way back up to retrieve his pack, and sat on the log again to decide what to do next. His hands were shaking with shock. He had never been to whatever this village was called. He had only been out of Krebsford a dozen times in his life, and never so far. Yet, somehow, even here, in this village, several long days' journey from Krebsford, people knew about the awful jinx Corin Bladewell. Knew that Corin Bladewell was trouble, a jinx, and wanted to keep him out of their town. They chased him out of town before he could even say hello. Had the Baron sent word around Crichton County to warn people about Corin, perhaps all of Winterthur Province was on the lookout for Corin the Jinx. There would be no place he could go. No town that would not have heard of him by the time he got there, or would hear about him shortly after he arrived. The boy who causes trouble. Good riddance to him. Corin sat on the log until the sun was directly above him and sliding down towards the western horizon. He still needed to find his parents. Perhaps he should go back to where they left him. Yes. That was the best idea. He climbed down the hill and cautiously walked out onto the road. The town was around a curve, unseen behind him. Corin trudged miserably down the road, past several farms. No one noticed the lonely boy passing by, until he came upon another boy, around his age, sitting on a stump, eating what looked like a blueberry pie. Corin's stomach grumbled with hunger. He hadn't had anything to eat since noon, the day before.
Hey, said the boy. What you doing?
Nothing, Corin said defensively.
That looks like a good pie. It is, and it's mine.
The boy hugged the half-eaten, stolen pie to his chest.
My ma made it for me.
He lied as he ate another mouthful of stolen pie, the blueberry juice running down his chin.
I'm Roddy. You're not from around here, are you?
No.
Did you see a wagon come into town yesterday afternoon?
Corin asked hopefully.